We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined this week by an old friend of the podcast, amongst much bigger distinctions. He is an award-winning journalist, a longtime Chess Life magazine columnist. He writes the Chess to Enjoy column, which I always enjoy. He is a prolific author of over 50 books, a World Chess Hall of Fame member, returning to the show for the fourth time, and we're excited to talk about his latest books, one of which is Smyslov Bronstein Killer Geller Taimanov in Averbakh. Geller was a killer, a chess multibiography with 220 games, and his newest book, which is 500 chess questions answered for all new chess players, one the latter being a guide for new chess fans and the other being a fascinating multibiography for all the chess history buffs. So we'll talk about those books and much more. But first, let's welcome him back. Grandmaster Andy Soltis, how are you, Andy?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, always glad to have you. And we should, as always, give the caveat that when I have the privilege of interviewing Andy, we do it via Skype. I call him from Skype to his phone. So if it sounds a little different than our other interviews, that is why. Although usually it comes out sounding pretty decent, and hopefully that's the case this time as well. So Andy, we've, as usual, I don't know how you do it in terms of your output of books. So we've got a lot to talk about in that regard. But I actually, Andy, wanted to start off this time talking about sort of chess improvement, because I know you've obviously written about this from many angles in addition to your chess history work. But what is your most succinct advice for how one should work on their game? And we have a more specific question from a listener, but let's start with that.
Well, I think the best thing to do is learn how to analyze, because if you start looking at a position, any position, just pick something randomly that you see in being played today in a tournament somewhere that you found on Chessbomb, think about the position. Try to figure out what you would do in that position. What moves would you consider? Are there moves that you would immediately rule out? Try to identify the immediate tactics. What am I threatening? What can I capture? What can he capture? If you can do that, if you can analyze chess positions every day, you build up a tonal quality that is bound to pay off in the end.
So a little bit reminiscent of the sort of De Groot approach of just thinking in words about the position and then comparing what you think in terms of what you will learn a stronger player or stronger engine thinks based on what they actually do.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we talk about the quality of intuition, which is sort of a mysterious, you know, quality. You know, if you've seen the old movies on television, the detective is asked, you know, what are you looking for? And he says, well, I'll find it when I know. I'll know when I find it. He's intuitive in that sense. And that's what happens with chess. You try to build up this internal sense of there's a move that's appropriate in this type of position. I should know it. And if I've had enough experience with similar positions, I'll figure it out. That's intuition. That's what you really want to develop.
And what advice would you give for people who do that but still feel like they just have more questions than answers? They try to work through that process, but then once they've done it, it can be hard to sort of square the circle of what you were thinking versus what is correct if you're not working with a coach.
Yeah, this is a problem. I mean, coaches are not supposed to answer your questions. They're supposed to ask you questions. They're supposed to get you thinking. And the problem today is that people have computers and they think that they'll get all of the answers to their the mysteries that confront them. You know, why didn't Carlsen play knight c6? Well, the computer will tell you, give you a variation, but you need words. And you're going to have to get words from books and other sources, and sometimes you just analyze with another person. Sometimes I think the ideal situation is to analyze with two or maybe three people total. If you get more than that, you get too many hands moving pieces on a chessboard, you know, arguing about a position on a screen. But if you can talk to other people and get their line of thought, maybe they can come up with the answers, and you'll get the right answers.
Okay, yeah, that's good advice. And of course, those of us who grew up in the analog age, that's you kind of had no choice but to develop that way, hanging out at chess clubs like the Marshall and the Manhattan, may it rest in peace. And these days, of course, you can do it over Zoom as well. And this kind of ties into what I mentioned. We've got several great Patreon mailbag questions. So thanks to the Perpetual Chess supporters for sending those in. And I want to get into the first one because it's on a related topic. So it's from Igor Feinstein. Igor, listeners who heard a recent question, I believe it was for Noel Studer from Igor. Igor is grinding hard on the chess puzzles. So shout out to Igor. And he asks, what is your view on what is better for adult improvement in chess, specifically category level players, studying with books or using online resources? I still cling to the idea that studying with books leaves a stronger and longer term impression on the chess mind and that books are a better bang for your buck. But maybe I'm missing something regarding online resources like YouTube or Chessable or even lessonsonchess.com. And he also mentions he recently read your book, Inner Game of Chess, cover to cover in 2 to 3 months.
Good. Well, thanks, Igor. That's a good question. You know, there's actually two models there. You're going to find great players who grew up just on books and others who never read books. I mean, you know, famously, Hikaru Nakamura said that he considered the classic books a waste of time. And when, you know, one of his teachers said, you should study Steinitz games, he exclaimed to his father, why do I have to study the games of dead guys? And the other extreme is Fabiano Caruana, who, you know, when he was working initially, just learning chess basic stuff, with Bruce Pandolfini, Bruce had him read the classic books, look at them together. A lot of these, you know, Dover books that you could buy, the basic paperbacks, and go through the games of, you know, Morphy and so on. And I was happy to hear from Bruce that, you know, even one of my books they looked at. But my basic point here is that there's two types of studying. One is active and the other is passive. And the trouble with videos, YouTube, is that you get into a passive situation. You're like in a classroom with a teacher who's never going to call on you, so you can, you know, nod off, you can like listen to it, and you're not going to participate in any active sense. You know, it's like watching a TV commercial, a show, and a TV commercial comes on, and when it's over, somebody might ask, what was that commercial about? What were they selling? And you may have no idea what it was. You've seen that commercial dozens of times, but it doesn't penetrate your consciousness because you're not engaged. The best way is to be able to talk back, and you can talk back with a book. You can stop on this page and say, you know, well, like Yasser Serwan, I quoted him in 500 Chess Questions Answered. He loved to read books because he had a hostile attitude towards the author. He would say, no, you're wrong. I don't believe that knight, I don't believe bishop takes knight is the right move there. And he would set the pieces up on a board. And I think using a board is actually pretty good because it's better than a screen. You're going to be, when you play chess, you're going to be using a board. You're not going to be using a two-dimensional screen. But he would set it up on the board and try to prove that the author was wrong. And if he was wrong and the author was right, well, it got him studying. And I think that you need some sort of active participation where you're feeding your mind and you're challenging yourself. This is a little bit of ancient history, but you may remember going way back when Bobby Fischer played for the World Championship, the New York Times sent one of their best reporters up to the Catskills, to a resort where Fischer was studying and training. And he didn't come up with very much information, except that Bobby was carrying around something that was known as the Big Red Book. Like, you know, people in New York knew what he was talking about. They were talking about something. There was a collection of Spassky's games, didn't have any words in it. It was simply moves. And it was this German series called the Weltgeschichte des Schach. And it had a diagram every five moves. And the great thing about that is you could play over a game. You look at the diagram. You can then look at the moves. See if you can remember the moves and visualize the game as it's then being played. And then when you get to five moves later, you have another diagram. You can check yourself. And that's how the kids in my generation learned how to visualize. And some of us even figured out how to play blindfold chess. And of course, you don't have to play blindfold chess to be good, but it did. And it does marvels when you read a book and you don't have to look at the analysis. Just look at the moves that were played, the bold-faced moves, and go from one diagram to another. And you'll see, you know, marked improvement in how much you digest.
Wow, a lot of insights there, Andy. So, I mean, in terms of a takeaway, I guess, is it fair to say that what you're saying from Igor's question is it's not so much whether what you do is online or in a book as that you you ingest the material in an active as opposed to a passive fashion, whichever material it is?
Yes, I mean, that's the same thing as when you're in a school classroom. You have to, you know, get yourself involved. You have to be a participant. Passive learning simply doesn't work.
Yeah, and on a sort of related note, you know, of course, I'm quite active on Chess Twitter, and we have a great community, the Chess Punks, that talk a lot about sort of looking for book recommendations and improvement recommendations and stuff like that. And I remember recently at some point, someone tweeted out something like either looking for a recommendation or making one about a certain chess book. And Grandmaster Daniel Gormley responded. He said, you know, you guys need to stop talking about chess books and just play chess. Which there's also an air of truth too. I mean, you also, you have to learn by doing as well. So how does that mix into the cocktail, Andy?
Well, another of the questions in 500 Chess Questions Answered was, what's the proper mix between studying and playing. And I remember this was asked of a number of strong players a number of years ago, and they were all over the map. They were saying, you know, 70% study and 30% playing. And somebody else would say, no, it's 62% playing. And you know, they were having all sorts of variety. You can become a very strong player. I think John Watson, the great book reviewer, since he gave me a good review, became a strong player purely by reading. Vasily Smyslov, you know, never played outside his home until his father thought he was emotionally ready to play chess. And I think he was like 15 at the time. So he just studied stuff in his father's library. Father had an enormous library for the time. And you can quite easily do that. Alternatively, you can find players who just, you know, played chess constantly. You know, I remember Walter Brown when he was young, he was just playing, you know, constantly wherever he had a chance. And you can improve that way. I think you have to find what the mix that is most comfortable for you. Not the one that you're going to, you know, you may not know what you're going to benefit from the most, but what you enjoy the most. And see if that works. If you're playing bullet on ICC every day for 5 hours, yeah, that might not be the very best use of your time. You know, that you have to put a stop to yourself. But, you know, everybody develops bad habits, and chess players develop some of the worst.
Yeah, although, of course, Hikaru, no stranger to bullet chess, and this is going to come out in a few weeks, Andy, but as we record on November, I believe it's 4th, on November 4th, Alireza Firouzja looks primed to secure a slot in the candidates with three rounds to go in the FIDE Grand Swiss. Now, things could change, but either way, the broader point is Firouzja is no stranger to bullet chess either, but somehow for some people, it seems to work. So I guess to summarize sort of the broader conversation, there's differing opinions on everything, but basically if what you're doing isn't working, try one of the other advocated approaches.
Yeah, exactly. You know, players have become good in any sort of method. They have done it in places where there were chess clubs. They've done it in remote locations. They've done, and now, of course, you have the internet, so that nothing is really remote. So you have quite a choice out there.
Yeah, and so Andy, you've been retired from competitive chess for a while, but what type of chess learner were you? To what do you attribute your success?
Well, I never had a teacher. that sounds, and I grew up reading books and going to the Marshall Chess Club. I remember reading Reuben Fine saying that he never read a chess book, but until he became a really strong player. And then I found out people at the Marshall said, yeah, but he used to come to the Marshall 7 days a week and spend 6 hours a day. I couldn't possibly do that. I really can't explain how I got as good as I did, particularly in my college years, because during my college years, chess was probably the fourth priority. I had to keep my grades up because if I didn't, I would lose my draft deferment, and I could very easily end up in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. And second priority was probably working on the college newspaper. Third, I was working part-time the middle of the night as a copy boy at the New York Post to get a foot into journalism. Chess was the fourth priority, and somehow I managed to juggle it all. I don't think anybody else, you know, not everyone can do this, but I think you can try to find the right niche for chess in your life and see how it works.
Yeah, there's always a sort of mystical element. And I think, you know, in the mortal words of Bobby Fischer, I just got good. I think a lot of, like, especially the grandmasters like yourself that I interview, like, they can talk about books that they read and, you know, teachers who made an impression and stuff like that. But there is something hard to describe about, like, they just accelerate for a while and then it stops. So often it can be hard to, for people looking to try to sort of mimic that. Now, hearing you discuss this, Andy, makes me want to jump ahead a little bit. I want to talk about your biography in detail a little bit later. But one thing you mentioned in it is, and I know you mentioned John Watson has a rave review in the December Chess Life. I echo his thoughts. I greatly enjoyed reading this. Yefim Geller had kind of a legendary jump in strength from candidate master to world elite in like his early 20s. Do you, in all of your research, I know you mentioned he's sort of like a chess professor anyway, harder working than anyone, but did you have a sense of what he might have done to make such a historic jump in chess strength?
I think he was a he was a guy who would sit at the chessboard and just alone in his room and work on chess constantly. And that doesn't always show up. You can make quantum leaps in chess, and many players do when they start out, and then you hit a plateau. And that plateau, you know, that plateau might be a rating of 1,300, and you can't go beyond that. Your natural talent got you to 1,300. It's not going to get you past that. Or your natural talent can get you to, you know, 1,800 or 1,900, or and in Geller's case, it was close to master. But I think that eventually it paid off, and it pays off in mysterious ways. You really don't know that you've gotten better just by rating. You learn. It's not like you have eureka moments when you suddenly realize, oh my God, now I understand the isolated queen pawn, or now I can figure out, you know, how to win queen and knight versus rook. You know, that's not going to happen. What will happen is that you will ingest information, and you won't know that you know it. That's the strange thing about chess. The more you know, and you don't know that you really have that information, and it really won't show up until you start, you know, you'll be beating players that you never beat before, or you're winning games more easily than it never seemed possible. I know that was in my case when suddenly I was able to defeat opponents that had always given me enormous trouble, and I had terrible losing records against them, and suddenly, you know, I was able to win. I think in the case of Geller, you know, he had certain passions, and I think one of the stories I told in the book is about how he played Bobby Fischer in a tournament in Bled in 1961, and at the end of the game, and this is the game that's in Fischer's book, My 60s Memorable Games, and it was their first game, and Geller collapsed and lost, and then he heard a roaring standing ovation from the fans. And Geller was shocked because this was in Yugoslavia. This is the Socialist Brotherhood. These guys should be cheering me, and here they're cheering for this capitalist enemy. And Fischer became Geller's lifelong enemy. He just like became obsessed with Fischer and the way that Fischer would be described as a genius. And that's, I think, one of the things that propelled Geller further. I think he had this huge plus score against Fischer after that. I think he lost once more in the Curaçao candidates, and then he lost to him in the final game they played. But over the years, he was the Fischer slayer, and that's what drove him further. Simply that, you know, I have to get good enough so that next time I play Bobby, I'm going to beat him.
No better motivator than contempt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Funny, sad, but yeah, I think it's often the case that, you know, if you feel slighted or something, you know, it can really light a fire to keep working. You certainly see that a lot in sports. You know, there'll be like some elite athlete who everyone says is amazing, but it turns out all they fixate on are the criticisms, you know, like Kevin Garnett, when the Celtics won the championship in the NBA. Like, I remember there's this highlight of him yelling, like, what are they going to say now? But meanwhile, like, everyone knew he was an elite player. It's not like people were saying he's bad, but somehow that's the narrative in his head. And that's what can propel someone to be a champion, whether in chess or basketball. Now, Andy, before we talk more about your book, I did want to sprinkle in another Patreon question from Alex Friedman, because you've been talking about your own chess competing a bit. And of course, you mentioned the famed Marshall Chess Club, which has been coming up a lot on the show recently. Shout out to the Marshall, as always. And Alex asks, which one of your 9 wins of the Marshall Chess Club Championship is the most memorable?
Okay. Well, let me first preface that by saying the club championships in those days were quite different because you went to a chess club to play in a tournament. There weren't weekend tournaments in a hotel run by a tournament director. Tournaments were held in clubs, and they were played usually one round a week. And you know, you would know the pairings maybe in the middle of the week, so then you would then prepare for it. It wasn't like they posted the pairings. I have 15 minutes. I have to cram for this. No, you got to actually study the game, study for your next opponent. You might adjourn the game, then in which case you can learn something about the end game when you, you know, prepare for the resumption of play. And that's the tournament that I grew up on. And the funny thing is, I can remember tournaments that I should have won, or at least I felt I should have won, Marshall championships, much better than I do the ones that I won. You know, the thrill of victory is never as good as, never as memorable as the agony of defeat. I can remember specific games. Every time I played Orest Popovich in the Marshall Championship, and I seem to do that every year, we had a game that, like, you know, really got me going. And I remember some wonderful dragon variations that I played against him. And I can remember a game when I resigned against Joe Tamargo at 1 year that he won the club championship. And that became sort of a famous game because I resigned in a position where I thought I was getting mated, and I wasn't. Of course, I was dead lost in the position, but, you know, this became a sort of a myth that I resigned in a drawn position. In fact, I've done worse in other things, but... So, you know, the short answer to Alex's question is I really don't have a club championship that stands out. The first one I won, I know I won it by a score of 7-1. That's the only thing I remember about it. I don't remember any of the games. I remember games from other championships, even in the late 80s when I think I last won it in 1988. I don't remember, you know, some of them nearly as well.
Huh, that's funny. Yeah, and I think that's another thing that's common in chess and sports, that the losses can just sting so much more. Well, thanks for that stroll down memory lane, Andy. So I want to dig deeper into your book, your multibiography, I should say. But first, let's take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by our old friends at Chessable.com. Hopefully you know by now about their proprietary move trainer technology that helps you remember tactical patterns as well as opening sequences. Whatever aspect of your game you're looking to work on, there is an excellent chance that Chessable has something for you to help. They're also constantly releasing new courses in the pipeline. Currently, they've got a lifetime repertoire 1E4 from none other than Anish Giri. And they've got the Ginger GM, Simon Williams, soon to release a treatment of legendary Grandmaster Alexei Shirov's Fire on Board, plus so much more. So just be sure to always go to Chessable.com and take a look at what's new. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by aimchess.com. Hopefully by now you guys are all aware of their awesome algorithm that gives you actionable tips to improve your game. But on this ad, we wanted to make sure you're aware of the Magnus Nepo Prediction Challenge. Go to magnusnepo.com, sponsored by AimChess. And they basically ask you a bunch of questions to make predictions based on what you think will happen in the upcoming World Championship. And there's lots of prizes like chess boards signed by Magnus, Chessable courses, premium membership to Chess24 and AimChess, et cetera, et cetera. So fun opportunity. You can even have groups with your friends. So be sure to go to magnusnepo.com. Before the much-awaited World Championship begins.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
And we are back. And yeah, I can't really say enough positive words about Andy's multi-biography. It's just a beautiful book from McFarland and Company, a pleasure to read, but a nice combination of games with good, clear annotations, plentiful annotations, and biographical information. But Andy, I mean, it's a big undertaking. As regular listeners may remember, you were kind enough to join Nate Solon and I on the Zurich 1953 recap, and that was months ago. And as I told you, I need time to read your book. And now I read a lot of books for the people that I interview and the book recaps that I do, but it's taken me a while because I've just been kind of savoring it and putting it down and coming back to it. But to give listeners a kind of preview, Andy, I thought maybe we could kind of free associate about each player, give them a little chess history lesson. Does that sound like a good plan?
Sounds good. Shoot.
Okay, so let's start with Smyslov, the headliner. What comes to mind when you think of Vasily Smyslov, or what do you think is a memorable story you could share for listeners?
Smyslov was a contradiction, because he was a deeply religious man. Both he and Yuri Averbakh remembered one thing from their youth. It was the same event, and they both heard about this great church, the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow, and it was blown up. It was blown up on Stalin's orders. I remember seeing that site on my first trip to Moscow, and it was a swimming pool. And Averbakh remembered it because, of course, it was this fantastic explosion. Everybody in his class were, just amazed that this could happen. And of course, Smyslov was absolutely horrified. There aren't very many religious chess players, deeply religious. Vasily Ivanchuk, I guess, is the most memorable in recent times. But he had this strange, or rather unique personality, Smyslov. There was a tournament in Havana in 1965. It was the first hybrid tournament, I guess you could call it, because Bobby Fischer was playing from the back room of the Marshall Chess Club, and his moves were being transmitted to Havana because he couldn't get a visa to play in Cuba. And Smyslov was the head of the delegation, the Soviet delegation in this tournament, and one of the players was a guy named Ratmir Kholmov. And Kholmov, I met in towards the end of his career. He was this like barrel-chested ex-stevedore salesman. Went out the night before he's playing Fischer and got very, very familiar with Bacardi rum, let's put it that way. And the next morning, Smyslov found him and he was hungover. And as the head of the delegation, he had a responsibility to energize poor Kholmov, who was, in awful shape. But instead of berating him, he said, look, what are we going to say when we go back to Moscow? What are you? You're a great player, and you're going to be embarrassed when you lose to Fischer. And he said, look, here's a system that you could play against him. You're going to play the Roy Lopez, Bobby likes this pawn structure. Here's what you can do it against him, and you do that. And then he might fall for this cute trap that you can set up. And sure enough, Fischer fell for it. And it just, knocked Fischer out of contention for first prize. Kholmov went home as a hero, and nobody remembered Smyslov's role in it. And that's the perfect way of, for Smyslov to act like that. He would like to be the guy in the background helping out in his own quiet way.
Excellent. Yeah, and I really, really enjoyed the Smyslov section. And for listeners looking for more on Smyslov, I definitely recommend FM Andy Andrei Tarakov's book, as well as my interview with him. But Smyslov is, I think, well covered in comparison, I think, especially to Geller, Taimanov, and Averbakh, who we will get to in due time. But let's hear about Bronstein. And I have a specific question about Bronstein. But first, let's hear you free associate.
Okay. When I think of Bronstein, I think of him as a vagabond, because he traveled. He never really seemed to have a home after he left Kiev, and he left Kiev at the beginning of World War II for the Soviets when he was invaded. He just got out in the nick of time. Had he waited a short time longer, he would have died with many of his friends in the massacre at Babi Yar, when the Nazis basically eliminated the Jewish population of Kiev. And he traveled about, you know, for 2 years trying to find a place in the Soviet Union during that period of war. And at the end of it, he was sent to Moscow by he had a benefactor who was in the secret police. And he was sent to Moscow to play in the Soviet championship. And he ended up wearing the only thing he had, which was a green cotton suit. And the head of sports committee, the Soviet sports committee, was outraged that he showed up every day wearing this sort of ludicrous costume. And one day he was playing Botvinnik. And Botvinnik was, you know, considered a god at that time in the Soviet Union. And he was outplayed by Bronstein. And they resumed the game, and Bronstein is winning. And one of the things about chess players that I've always found remarkable is that they can put themselves in their opponent's mind. They can think what their opponent is thinking about the position, but chess players often have no empathy.
So, that's true, yeah.
And here's the case where Botvinnik makes a move, Bronstein replies, and then Bronstein gets up and walks away to get a glass of tea. And when he comes back, there's no board left, literally no position, because Botvinnik has resigned and the tournament director has removed it. And both of them felt insulted. Botvinnik felt insulted because why didn't he wait around for me to resign? And Bronstein felt insulted. Why did he resign when I wasn't there? And that's the type of misunderstanding that I think plagued Bronstein throughout his career. As wonderful a player as he was, as many incredible insights that he had about, you know, like the future of chess and things like that. But that's what I think, you know, sticks out about Bronstein.
Yeah, it was striking, the insights he had into the future of chess. I mean, you write that he foresaw rapid chess increments, even chess streaming. It was amazing to see at a time when someone like Smyslov was like, you know, anti-chess computer, Bronstein sort of saw it all coming.
Mm-hmm. He had a fantastic view, but he liked to toss out ideas. You know, he'd toss out an idea and maybe this will work and maybe it won't. And that's, you know, and nobody else would think about it. and they would just say, well, you know, that's Bronstein. He's crazy.
And then the question that I teased earlier that I can't help but ask about, I don't know if it's just me who has like a special interest in the sort of match fixing allegations that kind of permeate that era. But you write about his candidates match with Boleslavsky, where he went on to play for the world championship. And apparently, I mean, this has been, you know, rumored over the years and written about over the years, but Andy, your conclusion is that this some sort of deal was probably struck for Bronstein to emerge in this classic 14-game playoff against Boleslavsky.
Well, I was relying on the reporting of other people, especially Gennady Sosanko, but and the quotations from the players themselves, from Bronstein, from Boleslavsky, and from Bronstein's protector, Boris Weinstein, who was, I think, the real inspiration for the evil character in Ian Fleming's novel From Russia with Love. And what happened was that they, before the end of the candidates tournament in 1950, at the inspiration of Bronstein and Weinstein, they tried to convince Boleslavsky to give Bronstein a chance to catch up, and he did. And he Boleslavski drew his last two games. Bronstein won his last two games. And then one of those games, in fact, was a magnificent victory by Bronstein over Paul Karras, his nemesis, who he somehow managed to get, you know, to win a remarkable number of games. And their idea was that they would go and say to FIDE and the Soviet Chess Federation, look, instead of having this world championship, you know, match that everyone talks about, how about if we have like a three-player match tournament? And they had just fixed the finish of a candidates' match, a candidates' tournament, and now they wanted to fix a world championship so that, you know, Bronstein and Boleslavski could gang up on Botvinnik. And, you know, that didn't fly. So they were forced to play the Bronstein-Boleslavski match. And it was a... it's hard to figure out some of those games because some of them look like they were prepared in advance, that they intentionally played these moves because they wanted to make sure that, you know, the result was... because they had fixed games previously. They had, like, composed games. And Boleslavski admitted at one point that in his career with Bronstein, you know, sometimes they spent more time composing the moves of a game before it was played than they actually took to play the games. And the bottom line was that they wanted to make sure that Boleslavski was not going to be the world championship challenger because they knew he would lose to Botvinnik. And both Bronstein and especially Boris Vainstein, his protector, his guardian angel, absolutely hated Botvinnik. And they claimed they didn't want Boleslavski to endure the suffering that he would if he had to be defeated. And, you know, the funniest thing is that the explanation of why this was justified is that, well, once Bronstein becomes world champion, then we'll fix the next world championship cycle. We'll make sure that Boleslavski is the challenger, and we'll make sure that he wins against Bronstein, and then he gets to be world champion too. It's absolutely scandalous, and, you know, it's not very well known.
Yeah, that was what floored me, too, the idea that we're not just going to fix this one match, but it's a quid pro quo, and we'll fix, like, you know, the next world championship as well. Just crazy to see. And interesting in terms of, you mentioned Sosanko's writing about Bronstein. I mean, Sosanko writes about how Bronstein basically never recovered from losing to Botvinnik. And of course, I also interviewed Sosanko, and we touched on that. And it's interesting that it seems like there's maybe a bit of cognitive dissonance if this is true, because he necessarily shouldn't have even been in that match, yet he felt like he could just never get over the fact that he was there.
Well, I mean, chess players are notorious for this type of attitude. They, you know, they expect to win. You know, it's that you need that positive attitude. If you don't feel positive about your chances, you're never going to succeed. You know, one of the stories that I told in the 500 chess questions answered was about how a woman named Ruth Herring, who later became a big official of the U.S. Chess Federation, came home one night to her home in San Francisco, and she found her there was a guest that they were staying with, her and her husband, Peter Biasis, and her guest was looking over her games. And the guest was Bobby Fischer. And Ruth said, like, well, what did you think? And Fischer said, well, you know, the problem is with you is you're too pessimistic. You have to, you know, think more positively. And Ruth said that, you know, really improved her way of thinking. And so if you go into a game and you know, if you don't have, you can really suffer with having too much respect for your opponent. And I think Magnus Carlsen said, you know, sometimes I go into a game thinking that my opponent can be an idiot. And then he tries to prove that that's true.
Right. Yeah. And that actually segues into our next figure, Geller, who we discussed before, but you mentioned that he was a sort of a professor's mindset, you know, whereas like he would study for many hours a given position, as you mentioned earlier and wrote about. But then at the board, it seemed like he still wanted to take the same approach. He was a perfectionist and a time trouble addict. So maybe some kind of lacking some of the optimism to just move and figure it out later.
Yeah, if Gaylor had had unlimited time, and of course he needed an unlimited number of cigarettes and an unlimited number of cups of coffee, I think for him caffeine and nicotine were two of the food groups. If he had all that, he would have been, he would have been world champion. People forget that he was the prime analyst for Boris Spassky in the Fischer-Spassky match, and it drove him crazy that Spassky was coming up with his own moves when they had analyzed a particular opening position extensively. And Spassky was the exact opposite approach, because Spassky was this idea of, you need a clear head. You should go to the board without the burden of too much analysis, which, by the way, he called, too much of an American approach, coming to the board with too much opening analysis. And in the end, the funny thing is that Gaylor blamed Spassky for failing to follow the preparation that was given to him. And that's the reason that Spassky lost the match, according to Gaylor. And Spassky said, it was my seconds who failed me. And that's the reason I lost the match. That's how it goes.
Yeah. And then we have Mark Taimanov, legendary musician as well as a chess player, and some controversy about Mark's some of Mark's actions in there as well. Where would you start with Taimanov, Andy?
Taimanov was I think the only true believer who absolutely loved communism. Most of the Soviet world champions were not members of the Communist Party, and Smyslov absolutely refused, and somehow managed to get away with it. I'd say the only three who became Communist Party members were Botvinnik, Karpov, and Kasparov. And Kasparov, I think, was the only one who became a member of the party before he became world champion, before it was an obligation. Taimanov believed that the Soviet system was working, and he writes in his memoirs, which I quoted extensively in the book, that what a great guy Che Guevara was, and how what an honor it was to meet him in Havana. One of the ironies is that his downfall in the Fischer, when he played Fischer, that was the beginning of the downfall, and part of that was self-inflicted, because he went to the tournament, the match in Vancouver, and he was getting a stipend for daily expenses, especially food. And there was a wealthy Canadian who supplemented his and gave him, Canadian dollars to spend on, so he could eat wherever he wanted, have the best meals that he could. But instead, according to his second, Vasyukov, what Taimanov did is he went to, a grocery store, and he bought, basically cheap foodstuffs so he could cook them in his 4-star hotel room and keep the dollars that he was given for the restaurants, so that he could take these dollars home and buy, goods that were not generally available in Moscow. And so he was like undernourished. And Vasyukov said, this is crazy. This is absurd, but it's true. And, in the end, this loyal communist, Taimanov, found that he had been, he had sort of been undermined by his own system.
Yeah, and then certainly I might have been hard to feel the same way about communism, given the treatment that he endured subsequent to being swept famously by Fischer in that match.
Yeah, he ended up, as he said, he had he had three professions. He was a chess player. He was a concert pianist. He was actually quite good. His wife was his partner in duets, and she was the lead. He was the second in there. In fact, when they broke up eventually, and partly because of his downfall, he tried to resume his career as a pianist with his son, who was also quite accomplished. But they were both of them used to being the second one in a duet, and they couldn't work together that way. But anyway, so he had two careers, and he had a third career as a writer. And he was quite a good writer. And all of a sudden, all three careers were disappeared because of the disgrace that he was in. And he went from being, you know, like one of the busiest people in the Soviet Union to the only unemployed person in the Soviet Union.
Right. And you mentioned reading his biography. I mean, I know he had the one book, like I was the Victim of Fisher. Was that what you read, or was there another source?
Oh, no, there's a much better one. I can't imagine why this book has not been translated. It's called Remembering the Most. And it's about his, its entire career, including his musical career and how, you know, he was studying with the great teachers in the Moscow Conservatory, what happened to him during the war, you know, how his aunt was left in, it was the Leningrad Conservatory, how his aunt was left in Leningrad during the blockade, during the Nazi blockade, and was eventually killed by cannibals. And this absolutely destroyed his family when they found out about it. But he was evacuated. He went through a marvelous career in performing. He had counted people like Shostakovich as his friends. I think Prokofiev might have been included. But anyway, he just, it's just like an enormous cascade of reminiscences. And again, okay, if somebody, you know, someone who's knows Russian, knows chess, you know, somebody go out and translate this book, because it's really, really very good.
Okay, paging Douglas Griffin. we'll have to get him on that. I know he's working on various translation projects and does a great job on that, in addition to his blog. And in his memoir, Andy, you also, of course, write about more match fixing, his allegedly or maybe even definitely purchasing a victory against Matulovich in order to go on to play Fischer. Does he address that in his book?
No, he doesn't. He could have talked of all sorts of, you know, strange machinations that went on for and against him. No, it's pretty certain that he bought his last round point in the Interzonal, and his reward of the Interzonal of 1970, and his reward of that was to play Bobby Fischer. And there's another, you know, funny story in that I mention, and that in the Soviet Championship that got him into the Interzonal, he had an adjourned game with Edward Gufeld, and they adjourned in a position where there was like very, very little chance of winning for either side. The position was so blocked, and Gufeld said, "Okay, well, we'll play off on, you know, such and such a date." They agreed on the results of the play. And then he found out, just by chance, Taimanov went to the tournament site and found out that the game was being played ahead of time, and then Gufeld was going to forfeit him. And they played another, like, 40 moves. Gufeld made virtually no attempt to win. And this was explained as just, you know, like a practical joke on the part of Gufeld's. But if he had been forfeited, very possibly Taimanov would have been spared the opportunity to play in the Interzonal, and ultimately spared the opportunity to lose to Fischer. The theme of the book is that there's all sorts of strange ways that fate plays with you, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad.
Yeah, Gufeld, of course, that's not the only allegation about impropriety from Gufeld. He's got quite a reputation, as does Matulovic. And one more thing about the Matulovic game. I always enjoy going to chessgames.com about these sort of specific games, because you can read the comments of amateur chess historians and professional chess historians speculating. And the title of they always give each game a title, and the title of the Taimanov Matulovic game that allegedly was bought is Caveat Emptor, buyer beware, since he went on to get swept by Fischer, of course.
Yeah, and by the way, that game I used in Pawn Structure Chess. Even though I knew that it was probably a fixed game, but the game is just so instructive that you can't pass it up.
That's funny. sometimes I guess fiction can be more instructive than truth. In like as a teacher, if you're trying to illustrate an idea, it can help to not be encumbered by what actually happened. Anyway, we've got one more player to cover, Andy. Grandmaster Averbakh, who's turning 100, I believe, in fairly soon.
Right, in February, I believe it is. He wrote some interview, I think, recently, where he said that he talked to a gerontologist who said, if you get to be 90, your chances are pretty good, 50-50, that you'll be 100. And he's going to make it, probably. Yuri is a great guy. I think of him as the wisest man in chess, and someone who has been sort of like the Talleyrand of Russian chess, because he seemed to survive in no matter who was in charge in the Sports Federation, who was in charge in the Kremlin. He was going to somehow, find a way to exceed. And the funny thing about him is that when he was still a scientist, he had a real career. A lot of the Soviet players had paper careers. Korchnoi was a historian. Yeah, right. You've probably seen the book by Vladimir Tokmakov called Profession Chess Player. He was technically a member of the Soviet Army. That was his paper profession. In fact, he eventually, I think he was a major by the time he left. And someone told me that he was officially an instructor in the Arab language in the Soviet Army. The fact that he didn't know anything about Arab didn't matter. It was just a way of, paying him, apparently. But the thing about Averbakh is that he had a legitimate career as a scientist. And he wanted to see if he could get a stipend from the government, because that would be, making him an unofficial professional chess player. And his family thought he was crazy. And the chess players he talked to thought he was crazy to give up a scientific career, because he would probably make more money. And in that time, the only way to make that transition, you would have to become a grandmaster. And they didn't have international tournaments as we know it in those days. I mean, you could still make norms, but it was very, very hard because there were very few tournaments. So he set a clock, an internal clock. He said, if I don't become a grandmaster in 2 years, then I'm going to go back to science. And his only chance was to make it to an interzonal, which he did, and to get close to the candidates tournament. And in those days, getting into a candidates tournament was basically the way you became a grandmaster. That's the way Fischer did it. That's the way Spassky, Petrosian, and so on. That's Taimanov. They became grandmasters not by making norms, but by getting into a candidates tournament. And he tells a funny story in his memoirs about how in the final round of the interzonal, when his chances of getting into the candidates tournament, were iffy, and he went to the arbiter's desk, and I think the arbiter was the head of FIDE, Folke Rogard, and he said, and they were trying to, determine like the top places in the tournament, and Averbakh had an urgent question. He wanted to know, what happened in the game between Golombek and Wade? And they looked at him. He was crazy. I mean, who cares about? They were fighting to see who was going to avoid last in the tournament, Golombek and Wade. But Averbakh had figured out the tie breaks. And if the right person won that game, then he would become a candidate, he would become a grandmaster, he would become a chess player. And on that random element, that's what happened. The right guy won, and he became a grandmaster, and that sealed his career. As I said, no, I think Yuri is one of the greatest inspirations and one of the finest players there is. It's my favorite communist.
That's funny. And it's been reported that he survived COVID this year. Andy, have you been in touch with him at all recently?
No, it's hard to get in touch with him because his hearing is not as good. I was told to make phone calls, and there's some problem with email. But otherwise, I think he seems to be in fine shape. Some players just disappear. We haven't heard from Spassky in quite some time. And he's going to celebrate, I guess, I forget which birthday it is, but that'll be next month. It's really a pity, but who knows?
Yeah, I emailed Kovalik shortly before he passed, just by happenstance, hoping to get an interview. And I don't know exactly what the state of his health was at the time, but his reply was, not this time.
He was in good shape. He just collapsed very, very quickly. I was in contact with him too. And it seemed like, he suddenly became ill and he didn't realize he had cancer and just, went very quickly. He was working on a book.
Yeah.
He was working on a book of his career on that was writing in Czech at the time. And I don't have no idea what happened to that book.
Yeah, sad. I don't know how quickly he deteriorated, but this was about a month before he passed.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll leave it there with your book. Again, I can't recommend it highly enough. If you enjoyed hearing Andy talk about all of these fascinating characters, there's so much more in the books, as well as some great chess analysis. So Andy, we're going to take one more break, and then we're going to talk a little bit about chess books more broadly. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by ChessMood.com. ChessMood was founded in 2018 by Grandmaster Avchik Grigorian. It's a chess education platform that gives you a structured path to work to improve your chess. For $29 a month, you get instant access to over 200 hours of Grandmaster-prepared video content and includes openings, middle games, and end games. They also have an active online community where you can find training partners and fellow chess enthusiasts. Don't forget to check out their free content. They have a great blog where their grandmasters share their own thoughts on chess improvement. I get it delivered to my inbox. So to learn more about Chess Mood and what they offer, be sure to check out their website, chessmood.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
And we are back, Andy. And we have one more Patreon mailbag question. This one, actually, we have two more, sorry. But this one is from Bruno Johnson, which was the name of my dog. So Bruno has a special place in my heart, even though I don't know this Bruno Johnson. And Bruno asks, he says, if you were given an infinite amount of time and resources, as well as access to anyone currently alive, what would be your perfect book to write?
It's a toughie. I would like to do an oral history of the leading players in the United States, the leading players in the world. And that would not just a series of interviews, because, interviews in chess magazines are generally awful. They're basically just question and answer transcripts, Q&A. And they're fine as long as the Q's are good and the A's are good, but in most cases there aren't. And, if you read an interview with, say, someone like, Gata Kamsky, you realize what an awful interview can be. But an oral history would you subtract the cues to just give people a chance to talk about their times, what it was like to be, a chess player in their era, what it's like now, what they remember. I've been trying for years to get John Fedorovich to write a book. And because he's a fascinating person and he has all sorts of wonderful stories, when you hear him talk about his run-ins with, non-chess players like Marlon Brando, Katie Couric, and as well as some unprintable stories. I'd love to get that. John just keeps, refusing. I think that, one of the problems is that we really don't know very much about the personal lives of a lot of players. We know what they're thinking about the Nimzo Indian, but, not much else. And, for example, you can be a big fan of, I mentioned Nakamura and Caruana earlier, you can be a big fan of one of them or both of them. And today you might think that, they're probably very similar people, they have similar views, they probably are big friends, and of course they're not at all like that, and yet the average player has no idea that that's true. And what I've tried to do in my Soviet books is to bring out the personal side, what their life was like while they were playing these great games, what motivated them to play these great games, and that's the type of thing that I really like to do in a book, but it requires so much work and so much tape to get it all done. Somebody else is going to have to do it,
and possibly some truth serum would be required as well, because a lot of these higher profile players, they understandably want to sort of control the narrative.
Yes, exactly. They want to save it, and by the time they're worthy to be interviewed, their memory begins to go. I remember Arthur Biscay wrote a book of his games, and he remembers vividly when Bobby Fischer fell asleep at the board against him, and he gives the wrong game, and it's not that game, it's a different game. And I asked him about that many years before, and he said, oh no, it's definitely this game, and Pal Benko, he wrote a wonderful book. And a lot of his details that he did in an interview at the end of the book are just not quite true. His memory of playing Fischer was somewhat wrong, and playing Tal, he played Tal in a zonal tournament outside of the Soviet Union, which simply didn't happen, and that they drew under certain circumstances, and nope, you didn't draw at all. That type of thing happens with a lot of players.
Yeah, unavoidable, but interesting, especially because that Benko book is the one with Jeremy Soman, right?
Yes, wonderful book, absolutely.
Yeah, I've been trying to get my hands on it, but it's like $400 online for the most part. So hopefully sooner or later I can track it down. One thing you mentioned to me in email on the topic of books, Andy, that I found interesting was, and I had a recent conversation with John Hartman of Chess Life, where we talked about this a bit, how it's kind of a new world in terms of like predicting what books will find an audience. You mentioned that your Magnus Carlsen 60 Memorable Games was your most successful, and had some theories about why that might be.
Yeah, I'm really very bad at predicting the reception of my books. I was going through my papers not that long ago, and I found a note that I had sent to my wife Marcy when we were dating, and I said, "Look, I'm just going over the page proofs for a book, and I don't think it's really going to sell well, but just in case it might turn out to find an audience out there." And the book was Pawn Structure Chess, which is 45 years ago. And in the case of the Carlsen book, I didn't know how this book was going to be received. And I can't explain it, because the book has really basically not been advertised. I think there was a brief one-time thing in chess life, and it hasn't been reviewed in I think there was a British online review, but somehow it's been selling better than anything that I have had since the Bobby Fischer Spassky match, since the Fischer boom. I'm not sure what's going on out there. I think there may be a word of mouth, and maybe since so many people are buying their books online, they're getting it from Amazon. What is said on Amazon might matter more than anything else. And if you look at the Amazon bestsellers, you know, you can you know, click on a chess book and see where it stands on the Amazon chess book selling market. And you can find the 100 current bestsellers among chess books, and the current, you know, the top newcoming chess books and the books that are most requested and so on. And what you see today, what you've seen the past year, are things like Chess Fundamentals and by Capablanca. How can that be? Why? Well, for one reason, it's in the public domain. You don't have to pay the author any royalties. But secondly, it was mentioned by Beth Harmon in The Queen's Gambit. And the same thing with Modern Chess Openings is a bestseller suddenly again, because it was in that series. It may be a little bit out of date by now, but, you know, the way that the chess books are bought and sold nowadays, I think, is quite different. You know, I remember book reviewers used to say, you know, they have to be critical about certain books because, you know, they're fighting for space in the bookstore. Well, no books fight for space in a bookstore anymore. There is no space in a bookstore. Books, you know, any book you can find is going to be available on eBay or Amazon, even some, you know, really obscure books. And when a new book comes out, it has some quick sales, and it needs some word of mouth. I think word of mouth might be the new method of reviewing books.
Yes, as you say, some combination of that and I guess Amazon reviews, and you know, it probably didn't hurt that your book is about Magnus Carlsen.
Yeah, well, you can't go too far wrong about something like that. I'm working on a book now on a similar book about Fabiano Caruana.
Oh, okay. It'll be interesting.
We'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, interesting to compare the Q ratings, as it were. Do you mind saying, Andy, how many books the Magnus one sold?
No, I haven't seen the most recent. I'm expecting the new one, the new royalty statement in 3 or 4 weeks. It's been something like somewhere about a dozen books a day.
Okay,
which is they're some days, you know, where it certainly doesn't do that well. But another thing is Pawn Structure is back on the bestseller list. I can't explain that. It just finds an audience.
This podcast may have a small part to do with that. I have to I have to plead guilty. But yeah, Neil Bruce and I did a podcast, mostly Neil Bruce, I should say, where he's adult improver chess player who's built a loyal following online because he reads and appraises so many chess books. And he recommended your book and Mauricio Flores Rios's updated book, excellent book, Chess Structures, as well. So that may have something to do with it. I'm not sure.
Great.
So on the topic of Magnus Carlsen, we have one more listener question, Andy, as we start to wrap things up. This one is from Dr. Andrew Perry, who asks, he says, my impression from casual observation is that Magnus Carlsen's chess ability is fading very slightly and that his true playing strength in the next world championship will be a few points lower than it was at the last World Championship. As an expert on Magnus Carlsen, can you comment on whether you think that's true? If you think it is, how much strength has he lost, in your opinion? And before you answer that, Andy, I should just add, I'm not positive when this interview is going to come out. The match may have already begun, but doesn't mm-hmm. impact your answer too much. But please go ahead.
Okay. Well, the first thing I say to Dr. Berry is that we have more data to work with on Magnus in the past 2 years than we ever had before, because he's played much more chess in the past 2 years than he has before. Unfortunately, almost all of it has been in speed tournaments, and that's going to be distorted information, because Magnus is a intuitive player. His intuition is maybe unrivaled. I mean, there's like two or three other players I can think of quickly, you know, Capablanca, Karpov, Spassky, who had an instinctive idea of the best move. Most of the other good top players in the world are concrete players, as they're called nowadays. They're calculators. Their primary way of finding the best move, or their idea of the best move, is by calculation. And often they have to go through their second and third choice, their second and third candidate, before they find it. That doesn't mean that they're not going to find the best move ultimately. Kasparov did not have the greatest intuition, but not compared to Karpov, but he did pretty well in the matches. And Korchnoi just worked harder at the board in calculation than Spassky did in many of their games. So right now, I'd say it's hard to tell what Magnus's playing ability is, because we haven't seen him playing. I hate the term classical games, but we haven't seen him playing the classical games that's going to be required of him in the match against Jan Nepomniachtchi. What I wrote in Chess Life a couple of months ago is that Magnus is the underdog. I predicted he would lose by 2 points unless he regains the kind of intensive interest in winning the match. Remember, the last two matches were tied after the regulation classical games. He only won them against Karjakin and Caruana in the speed playoffs. So it's really hard to evaluate where he stands now. But the other thing to keep in mind, a lot of people don't know this. It should be obvious, I guess. 1 year from now, we're going to have another World Championship match. According to the schedule, you know, there's going to be another candidates tournament probably 6-7 months from now, and whoever loses in the Carlsen-Nepomniachtchi match is going to be seeded into that candidates tournament, and very possibly could win it. So we could have, you know, Nepo versus Magnus round 2 1 year from now. And in that match, I would bet on Magnus. Not necessarily this one.
Interesting. I have to respectfully disagree, Andy. Although one thing I want to add is, obviously, again, with the FIDE Grand Swiss ongoing, it's fun to let the imagination wander about the possibility of Faruja ascending quicker than one could have imagined. And I mean, he seems, again, this will be ancient history by the time this comes out, but he has excellent chances of securing a candidate spot, and he's already up to number 4 on the live rankings. So they may be on a collision course for next year's World Championship. Now, as to the match, my only question is if Magnus is winning Norway chess changed your assessment at all, Andy?
Magnus is winning
Norway chess. I mean,
yes, I know. He did. He looked very impressive in that. Yes, but one tournament is not going to be, you know, that clear evidence. It's matter. You know, we're only talking about 10 games, 12 games in these World Championship matches. A lot can change in the course of that, and you get behind. He's been remarkable in that he's been able to come back when he's behind in a match. that happened in the Karjakin match, and how he managed to tie that match and get into a speed playoff was really surprising. And I wrote about that somewhat extensively in my Carlsen book. I really don't know how he's going to how he would take something like this. Again, he has more confidence in himself than almost anybody else. But if you remember going way back when, he had an opportunity to get into a candidates tournament more than 10 years ago, and he declined because he didn't really have a strong interest at the time in becoming world champion. It would be, you know, he'd have to play in the candidates tournament, and then he would have to play in the world championship match. And, you know, he just felt that he wasn't ready for it. He didn't want to spend his time doing that. You know, anybody else in the world given the opportunity to play a candidates tournament would, like, you know, sell their soul. So sometimes he acts in mysterious ways. And, as I said in Cheslev, he's the real mystery in this upcoming match. It's not Nepomniachtchi. He's a known quality. It's Magnus. And which Magnus shows up for the match is will determine the winner.
Okay. Yeah. And as I always say, I can't wait. And Andy, I've probably informally, you're probably about the 12th person I've asked about the world championship match, and your only company in terms of thinking that that Nepo might be the favorite is Vladimir Kramnik. So you've got some good company at least.
Very good.
So Andy, this has been amazing as always. Do you have anything to add before we call it an interview and say goodbye until next time?
Nope, and I think by next time I'll probably have a couple more books.
Excellent.
That we can talk about.
Yeah, always plenty of things to talk about. So once again, the multi-biography is called Smyslov, Bronstein, Geller, Taimanov, and Averbakh. And for newer chess fans listening, 500 Questions Answered is also a great resource. It's got a little bit of chess sprinkled in, some diagrams and some illustrative examples, but it's also a lot of prose, just sort of walking one through the chess world, sort of answering questions about this this unique little I'm drawing a blank on the word microculture or whatever it may be. So Andy, thank you again, and look forward to continued books and conversations in the future.
See you next time.
Perpetual Chess is proud to be a member of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Be sure to check out their sports and pop culture related podcasts as well. I also, as always, would like to thank Matthew Passy for producing the show. Without Matthew, Perpetual Chess would not exist. And I want to thank everyone who listens to the show, whether it be on your own without telling anyone about it, keeping it secret, or if you're helping to spread the word, all the better, whether it be telling a friend about a particularly impactful interview, or whether it be writing a positive review online. All of that stuff helps get the word out and helps Perpetual Chess continue to grow. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those that provide financial support to Perpetual Chess. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible in its current form. And I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities. Here comes the list. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of Lazman Chess, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adaptive Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprenchess Twitch channel, Anidi Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, I am Dimitri Schneider, Douglas Wilson, I am Eric Rosen, Farhan Tharwar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Hampus Axelson, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin Gilmore, Kevin O'Callaghan, Kevin Pryor, King Selt, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, the law offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Michael Sullivan, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerd and Ace Twitch channel, Perry McManus, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Vlummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Ray Lillywhite, Reuven Fisher, Rick Rivas, Robert Hansen, Ross Crossland, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Steven Martinez, Sven Gierson, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patzers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Beam, and I also would like to thank the following, hashtag ChessPunks, who are the adult improvers on Chess Twitter, Ace Vallega, Adam Fowler, Adam Johansson, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio Leonfort, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Gruber, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brandon Halseed, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Bruno Johnson, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Ken Kabadayi, Chad Hilton, Chad Likens of Rose City Chess in Portland, the Chess Dojo, Chess for Charity Jacksonville, Chess Patzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabrie, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Best, Dave Saylor, David Blaskacek, David Brown, David Goris, David Hamblin, David Cramley, David Peterson, Dennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Eric Baldwin, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Mayo Perea, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letard Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Foote, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Gregory Higgins, Han Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jay Tuttle, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeff Davis, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Jones, Jim Ratliff, Jim Sadler, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Bannister, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Justin Goodfellow, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reifert, Lars Wiesen, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emilianova, a.k.a. PhotoChess, Mark Chaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Butolovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matt Ferrari, Matthew Coughlin, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, Pablo Davila, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passon, and Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Eckert, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randall Montgomery, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard McCormick, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Turner, Robert Wall, Robert Wilson, Rory Coleman, Ryan Berg, Samson Teaches Chess, Satyajit Malagu, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwater, Sergey Makagon, Seth Ruzica, Seth Will, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Simon Schmidt, Stefan Roller, Stephen Miller and Tom George, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Terry King, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Beauchamp, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, Zachary Hoskin, and Zhivkor Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thank you.
Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.